The afternoon speakers are going to come and sit up here so you can see them all while you have at them. But as I mentioned earlier, any questions, comments people want to send towards the morning speakers are, of course, eagerly welcomed. Where are the handheld microphones? Okay. Steve has one. You want to hand that one to Chris?
I'd sort of like folks to muse a little bit more on questions of context. Mark raised the context versus content question. I've been thinking a little bit about context versus ease of access, if there is actually a distinction to be made there. Are we, as archivists, all right with de-emphasizing archival context in favor of this ease of access and varied use and the creation of new, unexpected, perhaps ahistorical contexts that may develop around the material we're putting out there in this brave new world we face?
Well, I think that's a completely legitimate concern, and you know, my belief is that archival context is important, but it's everything. We should consider the implications of treating everything at the same level. I think one of the things that we have to figure out is how to successfully communicate context, which is one of the things that, when I got started in the profession, and the more that I worked with finding aids, even if they weren't an EAD, unless nine times out of ten, unless it was somebody who was a scholarly established researcher, they had no idea what they were looking at. And there are user studies that have been done saying that, what is this document, where am I finding the stuff that I'm actually looking for? And part of that might also have to deal with how we're actually writing these narrative descriptions of context, like scope and contents notes and biographical and historical statements. That's one of the things that I think we really have to engage with is, how can we communicate context more effectively?
I just wanted to add one thing. In that same session yesterday, or maybe it was the day before now, where the Library of Congress and Flickr discussion, there was also a discussion about Calisphere. And I think that is a fabulous example of thinking of your audience. So in that case, you're looking at K through 12 teachers of kindergarten through 12th grade, and you're thinking about what is it that they want? What is it that they're looking for? And it turned out in that case that they wanted basically curatorially selected groupings of the best materials, and they still link back to the finding aids. So if you want to get that greater depth of detail, it's out there. And I think that's a really great model, the idea of putting the information out there. Same thing as with the photos on Flickr. They have the photos out there. If you trip over this photo and you are the person who wants to know every little bit about the detailed background, there's a way to get back to the catalog. There's a way to dig deeper and read that finding aid. And maybe there's better ways of arranging within the presentation, to help someone know what does scope and content mean. But I think that, we have to be realistic that in many cases we're putting stuff out there, and it's a matter of leaving a place for someone to follow the trail home to the greatest detail if they choose to, but to know that if they may just look at the picture and go, wow, that's a great picture of a girl with some cute dogs. That looks just like the dog I had, and then they move on.
Something else that I was thinking about is these things are possible. I'm not suggesting that we completely throw away everything that we've done and learned over the last 10 to 15 years at all. I do think a lot of our established finding aids that are online, sometimes it's the best way to communicate. What we need to look into doing is supplementing that in a lot of ways. And a big point that I've been thinking about, given some of the work that I've been doing at NYPL lately, is making our metadata available to other people. Not just on a consortial basis. OCLC, for example, is opening up APIs for people to work with the data and develop new interfaces on it. We need to look towards not just sharing things between other archival institutions. We need to ultimately consider the possibility of allowing our users to play with our metadata.
I think I'm going to be provocative with this statement. I find context to be a little bit like jello. I find it a very difficult word. I think context can be so many different things. There's the context of records creation. There's the context of the record creators. There's functions and activities. There's mandates. There's organizational structures. Once you get the records, there's the context of where it is found next to items, within folders, within series. There's the context of use. There's the what contexts our processors bring to collections and what they choose to privilege and how they choose to privilege it. Our users, there's even the context of how they're going to use it, what they bring to the interpretation of materials. I constantly wonder what is context? What do we as archivists privilege as context, and what do we want to preserve, or kind of what authoritative view of context do we want to enforce? So when you hear context, I think it's something that has many meanings, and I don't think we can ever know all the various contexts that surround the materials that we care for. I think it is our obligation to provide infrastructures where we can capture and communicate as best we can what those contexts are, and we really have to allow these materials to be used in contexts that we don't even, we can't necessarily control or we can't expect. So, context. I often wonder what do archivists really mean by context when they emphasize that we really need to kind of preserve and promote this. I don't know.
Pervert it. I didn't mean that.
Michael Fox.
Let me ask you to think about reframing the question. Not in terms of content versus context, but in the light of the slide, I think I saw that said life is messy.
Everything
is messy. And how do we deal with a world which is messy and users who don't want it that way? Is that really what's at stake here? People who want, they don't want to deal with context, they don't want to think about context, they don't want us to tell us about context. I understand the deconstructionist attitude about meaning, and everybody imbues their own meaning to these things, and that's a legitimate point of view, but it does strike me that some of this is messy stuff, and can we stick our head under the modesty cloth here and say we're not going to deal with the messiness because our users don't want to deal with it, or we just say, okay, you don't want to deal with it, how far do we go?
I think that we do the best that we can. That sounds like a lame answer, but I think that we put in the effort that we can, because part of our job is not only to provide access to things that make our users happy, but in some ways to educate them a little bit about why certain things would be significant. Context is important, and there are lots of different kinds of contexts, and users may not care, but they should. it enhances their understanding and therefore makes society a better place. I mean, I'm going to go way out there. So we do the best that we can, and we describe the context that we can. We keep in mind and are flexible about those contexts that we don't necessarily understand, like how a user and his home in Timbuktu is going to use our objects. And so we do the best we can. And not beat ourselves up about it because we can't anticipate everything.
I think that one of the ways that we can be flexible is that instead of, so going back to the idea of the tree and whether the tree of exactly how everything is related, picking one way to represent it and saying that's the only way you can get at something, and imagining if you do have all of this metadata about your objects, and those are very fixed things, and we've chosen how to describe it and chosen which groups or how to classify something, providing people interfaces in which they can sort of choose the web that they want to look at that holds a bunch of stuff together. So if they really care about it from a chronological standpoint and they want to sort everything by date, we have to give them a way. That means we have to care about dates. You know, if they want to group things by subject, and we've managed to give subject classifications to 60% of our content, then for that 60%, they can look at it that way. If they want to do it by person or by relationships to other sets of data externally. One of the slides I almost included in my little stack here, there's a new tool someone's created for that's called Parallax. I don't know if any of you have heard of it. The free base database out there where people are working on, it's sort of like Wikipedia for structured data is the very simple way to describe it. So they've basically let people create structured sets of data, and everything in there is structured data. They've built something on top of that that can let you move between related sets of information. So it would let you say, show me all of the collections of information you have about Olympics. Okay, well, let me see related topics. Oh, you know about Olympic venues. Okay, show me all the Olympic venues. Hey, Olympic venues have sports teams associated with them. Let me look at the sports teams that play in Olympic venues. And you keep moving sort of sideways through these groups of information. And it's a fascinating way to imagine relating things. But it's all about having that data and drawing those relationships. So I'm really interested. The more structured ways, I loved your beautiful diagram with the circles and the arrows where we have these different standards that all connect together, and that if we can move between them, we're going to give people a lot of power where we don't dictate the one way they find it, but they can explore it. And in the end, they get to the one thing. If they want to go read the finding aid, I think it should still be there, and we give them a way to get to it.
Building off that, another thing that I've been thinking about a lot, and I've built a prototype, and I actually didn't show it today, was helping users find things more effectively. At my last job, I worked for the American Institute of Physics, we're a discipline-based history center, and we had a very, very self-selected community of researchers. And one of the things that I did with our data, we ran a union catalog for a subject-based union catalog for archival collections in the history of physics, was I took, all our data was in MARC. I took the 852 field for location and, ran it through some geocoding engines to plot it on a Google map, and, the 900-some repositories that we had, you would see clusters. So, say, somebody was going to D.C., they could say, oh, well, I can't, I'm going to go to National Archives, but, I can go to the Carnegie Institute, too. It's allowing that same sort of stuff, and again, there are users who, for a lack of free time, for whatever reason, are interested in doing this. People like to play around with stuff. Me, myself included.
Who's next? Yes, please. Yes, you with the white shirt.
I guess maybe just to continue that conversation.
A little bit. I'm the archivist for the Drawings and Archives Collection at Avery Library at Columbia University. And I think one of the struggles that I've had, or one of the challenges that I've seen with EAD, which I've been doing since about 2001, in dealing with architectural records, especially at Avery, we've sort of adopted a hybrid approach where we present the collection level information in a traditional EAD finding aid, but then at the series and sub-series level, we actually find that our patrons seem happiest if we link out to Excel spreadsheets that have structured data about our records at the architectural project level, so that users can sort by job number, by date of the drawings, by date of the completion of the structure, by architect, by landscape architect, by associated creators, by project name. So I'm wondering, so far, I really haven't seen a way to put that information in EAD, in the finding aid. It really needs to be sortable and searchable in a way that we've found only Excel spreadsheets can give us that functionality. So if you guys have other suggestions, I'd love to hear it.
It's not an issue with the data structure so much as building the interfaces upon it. that sort of thing, particularly with things related to date, you need to have highly structured date information. You need to make sure you're normalizing all your dates in addition to having the human readable formats.
We are doing that.
Yeah.
We're making it possible in the future. It's all EAD compatible.
Right.
But we just haven't found a way. It's not useful for our patrons to have it in that information in a strictly linear format.
I understand. It's just an interface needs to be built. So that, I don't know if that means, you know, coordinating with your digital library program. I don't know if that's something that should be grant-driven. But, you know, that's a great potential research area. That's, you know, that is something that can be done. The data allows it.
Yeah, I was going to say that having the structured data of something in EAD like that only allows for the potential of system functionality on top of it to manipulate it in a multitude of ways. I mean, that's really the backbone of EAD, right? All of a sudden, we can do what we want to do. We just need somebody to figure out how to build that thing that can reorganize the data on the fly for relevancy, however that it wants to be sorted. Basically, Excel's doing that for you.
In short, make friends with a programmer.
Right. Brownies. Coffee.
Go ahead. I've long harped on the fact that the potential of EAD is for us really to move beyond the paper finding aid. What I've discovered is, especially in a big consortium like the Online Archive of California, which is my context right now, people have been working at paper finding aids, and I find that we're really limited by that. So, for example, I thought it would be very cool, in addition to subit browsing, if we could allow the users to rearrange content to kind of provide the view that they would like best. If they didn't like alphabetical, maybe they could sort chronologically. And we discovered that people weren't putting containers next to every single component. So if they did decide to sort, they suddenly wouldn't be able to find anything anymore. So I find that we're really limited by the past practice of how we've encoded for the past 10 years. And as exciting as all these new interfaces, all the interfaces that we can imagine, I think the more you work in consortiums or consortia, the harder it is. You can control this. You can do all sorts of innovative things within your own shop. But once you start working with a lot of other people's data, I think it becomes increasingly difficult to be innovative in that way.
Of course, as you yourself pointed out,
microphone. Posterity, Steve.
But, you know, Michelle, as you yourself pointed out in your presentation, if you put container by every entry in the container list, then your word cloud is like all container, and yeah, that's all you're going to get when you come in from Google. So,
but that assumes, of course, that you're including that label on your front end HTML, right? So a lot of it ends up being how having the people who are creating the web experience based on the EAD data, that markup, how they present it is how Google's going to see it. So you may have that it's a container in the tags, but you may not include that label on the screen because it's labeled once at the top and you can tell that everything below that is a container. But it's just as an example.
Right, but on the other hand, I mean, one of the points I was going to make about Michelle's presentation was that when you're just dropped into the middle of a finding aid, and as you said, you have no idea where you are, there's no context there, there's no structure. Well, the context and structure is there. It's up on top. It's just a matter of making that display at the point that, you know, wherever you are, which would include, you know, implied container labels at that level as well.
Well, one of the things the OAC redesign is doing is actually redesigning the page so that when people are dropped in the middle of a finding aid, all the context is right there. And in a way, they're moving all the tag data around just so that so basically they're meeting that need.
When's that OAC redesign going to be up?
For contributors, it is going to be launched in September to review and comment, and then I think to the public, it should be March 2009.
Thank you. You have a question. Oh, somebody else here?
Yeah, and what I was going to say, I mean, there are also alternate ways to think about it, and I believe it was Henny who spoke about not using the container tag, but using the unit ID tag, so there, you know, we can move away from the concept of container and use other elements within EAD in order to assure that kind of location information, intellectual location or physical location as well. I mean, I think that EAD has that, there's a lot of space in there to do some experimentation on that issue.
Oh, microphone. I was
I would not dare speak without a microphone
was
in my hand.
Making.
Yeah, this is the international symbol for microphone. So Joey Ellison, Bunnell from Northwest Digital Archives. I think we're creeping around a topic that we've thought about a good deal as we've tried to do some OAI harvesting, just preliminarily. Our data, which is across 30 different institutions, 5 states, harvests quite beautifully at the collection level. There's a number of things, and Jean, you'll have to see as you play through with our data throughout the year how clean it actually is. But what we have found is that there's not a lot that we can do with the component level data. Now, this really bothers me, because the collection level data is, okay, it's a really big MARC record, but it's not that much more than a MARC record. It's the component level data where things actually start to get interesting, where you can find, you know, the classic search for the documentary edition of someone's letters. You go find them in all the other collections. What are some of your thoughts on how we might approach the component level data to have a chance to, for instance, do all these neat things you were talking about with it, Jean, yesterday, if that's where some of the arguably meatier stuff is?
One of the things that I expect to happen as I start pulling in all of these different examples of people's EAD from all different corners of the globe is that I'm going to find differences in practice. And I suspect what that's going to end up meaning is that the code that we write, the magic computer scripts that we use to take what's in the EAD finding aids and put it into our nice structured relational database is going to have to evolve over time. And it's either going to evolve as this is the script we use for everyone that it works with, and then we handwrite individual ones for large collections that, okay, all of these are done this other slightly odd different way. Or perhaps the scripts that we create will have to evolve in a way that can be adjusted so that some settings would be put, you know, one way or the other. Okay, this collection uses unit instead of series. So when I evaluate a number of the finding aids, I sort of figure out which philosophy they went with, and I set up my scripts to kind of understand how to pull stuff out. Honestly, for the Archive Z project, I really am focusing on the collection level information and trying to just do the baby step of getting enough overlapping subject terms, making sure I've got all my years mapped out, and making sure I have some idea how big the collection is in some common unit. And I figure if I manage to even do that, I'm going to be really pleased to have some big thing to look at. But I think we're going to have to be realistic. There are all of these different practices. People do different things. But that said, you know, if you go in understanding that that's what your programs are going to have to do, and that you may need some sort of middle ground of, okay, if I'm building some fabulous tool that people will be able to use on top of the data, there's going to have to be a data massaging phase. And hopefully, at least within collections from a particular institution, the pattern that they use, the rules they applied, I would hope, are common across the whole. I know that there are people who come and go, and this has been happening for 10 years. So what they did 8 years ago may not be what they did 4 years ago, may not be what they're doing today. And that may be a matter of working with the archivists who know their collections. They may say, okay, here's the 500 that were done this way, and here's the 8,000 that were done this other way. And that's fine, too. You know, just we're going to have to be realistic about it. And the more we can learn about practices and about being smart about snipping things apart and kind of putting them back together in a way that is common. You know, none of this is easy, but it's doable, I think.
And one approach, as coming from someone who has been
In the real world?
Doing EAD for 12 years now, and we've been doing it for 15 at the Bancroft. Practice has changed sometimes year to year. So encoding, depending on who was doing our encoding at the time and, you know, the tool that was doing our encoding, changed quite a bit. And we've been, in the last 2 years, migrating all of our data into an SQL database. And we're actually normalizing a lot of our data now. So we're taking 15 years' worth of finding aids, basically right now just the digital ones, in fact, and moving them into a database. And we're basically pulling all of our practices as closely together as we can over that long span of years, and we're going to re-export all those finding aids and all those digital objects anew as soon as this work is done. Yeah, so not that everyone can do this, but it can be done, and this is the way we're going to manage our stuff from now on. We've got a management tool that we built in-house over 15 years, and we're going to use that as our basis for a collection management.
Mary Evans? Mean this at all as a stupid question, but how did you justify doing that?
I got a great OT department who decided to do it for us.
MPLP, blah, blah.
Oh, well, because our systems office is doing it with my help. So it's, I mean, and I was talking actually to one of our archivists yesterday, that he shouldn't be involved in this unless we need him to be. That this should be machine done.
And he doesn't want to be.
And he doesn't want to be, exactly. He wants to be as far away from this as possible. Make my data pretty and leave me alone. So, yeah, I mean, the point being that they have someone like me who can manage that process with our systems office. Now, you know, how many people have someone like me and a systems office that will do this? But it's about getting our data in order. And this is a big step, and, you know, it's cleanup time.
I also expect that, you know, 2 years from now, perhaps there'll be tools that help people clean things up, where you could run your EAD through and find out sort of these are the components that are being used, or you have 500 that are using these components, and then these 600 do it slightly differently and help you by looking at the encoding for you. I mean, computers can do whatever you tell them to. We just have to choose what to...
Archivist Toolkit can, you know, supposedly import anyone's finding aid, and it's basically looking at those tags and pulling it in. So how consistent it is, I don't know, but that's a step in the right direction.
Also, to respond to Jody's question, based on what she was saying about OAI PMH, and this is something that Michelle brought up. This is the potential of OAI ORE, which is designed specifically to relate objects and to describe aggregations of objects. I mean, I'm not expecting that it will replace EAD, but it's something that will supplement EAD. And this is also the promise of, you know, RDF and linked data, that, you know, we need to maintain these relationships at very, very many levels. And it's going to be a lot of work. It's going to be a tremendous amount of work. And because of that, we need to move away from, this is part of my argument about moving away from a document-centered approach. We need to maintain our metadata using databases and other software tools. We cannot be encoding by hand anymore. It's not going to be effective. And maintaining our data in databases will allow us to, you know, put it out in so many formats that, you know, we won't have to, well, hopefully we won't have to worry about doing cleanup every time.
Michael, and then Karen, and I think we'll end the questions at that.
This is really a question for everybody who spoke today, because I heard a number of tensions around this issue of normalization. I heard all the speakers this morning talked about the need to normalize as part of aggregate collections, talk about normalizing just within the Bancroft Library, for example. On the other hand, I just heard an impassioned plea for RDF, which is the ultimate in non-normalization. When you start mixing 40 different namespaces together, how are we going to normalize that? And that's really the tension. And then the other part of it is the thing that Mark just referred to, which is this whole, and that's the namespace question, but how far are we going to open this up if we want to keep it normalizable? So you have the promise of RDF and the ability to create infinite numbers of linkages, but then suddenly, ask yourself how many different elements you want to be able to embed in an EAD origination tag. Do you want a mark data field tag? Do you want a Dublin Core creator tag? Do you want a friend of a friend namespace name element? I mean, how far do we want to go and then still be able to be normalized? But I would like to hear from everyone, too, as well as the folks in front.
Well, realistically, with RDF, you don't need to put it in the EAD. You can maintain, you could maintain it as a separate data store somewhere else. You need to have the RDF elements to have that unique identifier, which the RDF data is going to point to, and that's a completely legitimate question about, you know, how much are we willing to maintain? And I agree 100%, and that's part of the reason why I'm going to say it's hard work, but you also have to recognize that this again plays to the users who for lack of, for whatever reason have too much time on their hands. There are crazy people who like serializing things in RDF. So, that's my comment about it.
My question would be, how many of those things do we need to be explicit about in terms of our encoding, and how many of those things can be implicitly assumed about the data once it is structured in such a way that the person who is moving it from one space to another understands that structure? Do we need to identify Dublin Core creator with origination? I kind of think that that's an implied equal statement. Maybe Mark is more granular, so it has a little bit more specificity, so maybe that would be a better inclusion. But that question of, well, how much has to be explicit versus implicit?
The OAC redesign project often made me ask, are we going to build systems that are dumbed down based on the sad state of our data, or are we going to build fantastic systems that will encourage people to go back and fix their data or encode better in ways? And I'm probably more towards let's build systems that encourage better practice, and then we can encode in ways that kind of take advantage of this functionality, so that if we had systems that really were dependent on understanding an origination tag in a single way, it might discourage putting many different ways to kind of manage that data in there. So I'm inclined to let's look at build on that functionality, and maybe we can start putting in data that will take advantage of that functionality.
Let's go on to Karen's question. Angelica, you wanted to speak. Thank you.
Just a short point. We had long discussions with the EDL, the European Digital Library, how to consolidate the data to bring from our libraries, museums, archives, film archives, everything together. We have discussed about OAE, about OAE, and all these things, and everything was thrown away because it doesn't work. We have discussed about CIDOC, RDM. Also, this seems not to work. And so now for the gateway in Germany, we have said we want to consolidate without consolidation. We want to put everything together and then search across it, either in XML or in XHTML already, and then make the search across this thing. Because we want to preserve the richness of the description. And we don't have the resources to do things twice. We can't go back to this things that has already been described and make it new. That's not possible. So we need tools perhaps to update it and to change it, to convert it to a new form, but we can't do it twice. And so we have to live with what is there. And consolidation without consolidation is what we are trying for the moment.
And I think that brings up a great point that goes back to, we need to leverage the work that's going on in other communities to look from the outside into a messy set of lots and lots and lots of different pieces of content that have lots of ways of being described, and on the outside, from the outside, be able to say, look, you know, I can look at this and tell you that these two things mean the same thing. And the more that you do that kind of work later, and maybe that's some of the sort of thing that, you know, enthusiastic people with, the passion to list all the baseball players in a photo can give you, you know, for what it's worth, the search engines of the world, the tools like, you know, Google Search Appliances and Deca and all these other companies that are making it their business to be really, really, really good at looking at chunks of text and figuring out whether it's what you're looking for, those are going to get better as well. So while I am passionate about structured data and the really cool things you can do with it, I do think that there's a fallback point where the world of search, and if you're doing a decent job so that Google does find you and realize that your page is relevant, that that internal search engines as well, they're just going to get better and better and better at under, you know, seeing a group of words together that makes it think, oh, I think this might be what this person's looking for. I just wanted to put that out there.
Any other of our morning speakers like to have a word here? Should we go on to Karen's question? Well, I'd like to just to have the last word or the last question. Just kind of ask one that goes back to, basics in terms of what we're celebrating here on the birthday, which is just kind of satisfaction with EAD as this data structure that we're departing from, where we've put all this data in there and that has been so much criticized but so much implemented. All of the different kinds of things being said here about, yes, there's a lot of problems with inconsistent content, with content that may or may not be the right content with regard to its robustness for retrieval, inconsistent tagging, unsatisfactory presentation mechanisms, systems that aren't sufficiently integrated for cross-collection, cross-repository searching, on and on and on. So we know all the different kind of warts. You know, we need more tools, make it easier, all these things. Okay, but all that aside, and again, one isn't looking for cheers that, you know, that the gods brought EAD to us and made the world perfect, but I guess maybe, I mean, I'd love it if just however many speakers would just say something really, really brief, or the audience is equally relevant in this regard. Is it worth moving on from here, or as some people have said along the way, throw it away, it's just no good, we need something entirely different? I mean, I'm not looking for, well, you didn't say that, Chris. You know, I mean, and some of the ideas from this afternoon, you know, I mean, one could spend hours and hours, for example, just think about Michelle's comments. Okay, so we've got this data in this structured format. Okay, now take all of those ideas and where do they match? Or do they match? Or, you know, does the structured format and data test beds we have move into that, or do we throw it away and start over? You know, and again, we're now 5 minutes over and we're all tired and want to go home, but is there something simple and useful to say? Is it really badly broken? Is it a good place to depart from? Just about everybody has said something. Certainly we saw in these fabulous implementations this morning how much can be done with it. Jody. Microphone. Something simple, something to send us off feeling like we know the next move.
Having EAD has freed us up to at least have more interesting discussions about finding aids.
I love it.
In my first job, the main thing we discussed about was what was going to be boldface and what was going to be underlined and what was going to be indented until I thought I would go out of my mind. So I think it's raised the quality of the discussion quite a bit.
Okay, well, that's kind of, that's great. That's a very important thing. Okay,
I have something
ratcheted up a step or two?
I have something completely anecdotal. When I first started at Northeastern University, the focus of their collections is really on documenting underdocumented minority communities in Boston. And during the 4 years when I was there, we put the finding aids online, and I went from seeing no one in the reading room at all to not even really being able to leave the reading room to go to the bathroom or go to lunch because so many people were coming through the doors because they had found something on the internet that pertained to their community or to an organization or a cause they were really interested in. And what I was really struck by was the people coming through the door. There were some academics, there were some students, some faculty, but we really drew in an unexpected part of the community that we were really trying to serve. So I found EAD very empowering in that way because I was suddenly I was bringing the archives to the people in a way I never expected possible. So
I actually equate EAD to all the toys of my childhood, Legos, Lincoln Logs, all these things that you could put together pieces and all of a sudden you would build something, and it may not have been perfect the first time around, but you could take it apart a little bit and build it a little bit differently, particularly Legos. We had a big box, and I made, you know, I never made the same house twice, but, you know, I was able to kind of fix the errors that I made from before because the Legos were there. And I think of EAD data as kind of like that, you know, and now we have building blocks, and so we can move forward from that.
No, way better than pickup sticks, right?
Right, or HTML. We can compare it to that.
SAA has, you know, we all know SAA has these strategic initiatives, their diversity, advocacy, and technology, and, you know, I've been thinking about that a lot this week, and basically how the three of these are really, really interconnected. And, you know, as Michelle said, you know, putting the finding aids online really opened up, you know, the people who were coming into the archives. And, you know, with Jean's examples with visualization, that's a really, really easy way to show administrators if you're, you know, the richness of what we have in sort of a, you know, very, very unambiguous way, rather than, you know, handing them a bunch of finding aids and say, well, look, well, you know, we've got all these collections on this. This is, you know, it's a really unambiguous way of saying, these are what our strengths are, and, you know, this is why, you know, as an institution, you know, we're important. This is why archives are important.
And that we have data that tells us this.
Precisely.
Well, I always believe in ending a meeting on an optimistic note, and I think you've just given us that, all of you who commented there. So thank you so much for coming, and thank you to Chris for getting us launched and organizing us, as she is so good at doing, and Jen and Marilee for making it all happen, and happy birthday, EAD.